All right, thank you all for coming. This is the last of our lectures on what I have chosen to call urbane skepticism. We're going to be focusing this time on the work of John Stuart Mill and Matthew Arnold, and John will point out a couple of links to things like this as we go along, so keep one eye on the chat window. There are some recurring themes that we have to look at, methodological issues in particularly here having to do with the qualification of the witnesses, their education or ignorance, their credulity or skepticism, reputation or obscurity, sincerity or interest. But as you'll see, when we move into these Victorian skeptics, these writers who flourished after the accession of Queen Victoria to the British throne, there's a distinct emphasis on the literary questions, the questions of the distance that a written record places between us and even the supposed firsthand reports of the events. So keep your eye on that in Mill and in Arnold. Urbane skepticism, I've said, is a primarily English phenomenon, and in Gibbon we saw that it consisted with heavy doses of irony. But as we move into these later urbane skeptics, we're going to find that the irony largely falls away. They are sincere. They are not really interested in getting into some kind of a flame war with the Orthodox Christians. So irony is not their primary tool. They bring forward more straightforward assertion, and even sometimes, especially in Arnold, a certain moral earnestness. You may be wondering, can a 19th century highly educated Englishman write in a manner that is not urbane? To give you an example of that, here's what I will call rabid skepticism from W.K. Clifford's lecture, The Unseen Universe. Quote, "These sickly dreams of hysterical women and half-starved men, that which you keep in your hearts, my brothers, is the slender remnant of a system which has made its red mark on history and still lives to threaten mankind. The grotesque forms of its intellectual belief have survived the discredit of its moral teaching. Take heed lest you have given soil and shelter to the seed of that awful plague which has destroyed two civilizations and but barely failed to slay such promise of good as is now struggling to live among men." Clifford was not a soapbox ranter. Clifford was a mathematician and gave public lectures. This is an example of the tender solicitude with which he treats Christian belief. This kind of rabid skepticism annoys Matthew Arnold very much, because Arnold thinks, quite contrary to Clifford, that there's something absolutely precious and valuable contained in Christianity, swaddled in dogma, like the seed is encased in the husk. We want the kernel, we want the seed. The husk, yes, that has to go. So you'll see that Arnold is totally opposed to the spirit of what Clifford is saying here, and even signals out Clifford at a certain point for criticism precisely for these kinds of statements. But we start with John Stuart Mill, born in 1806, died in 1873. He was an English philosopher, a political economist. He was the godfather to Bertrand Russell. His father was the noted economist and author James Mill. James was a friend of Jeremy Bentham, and they set utilitarianism on the map in British philosophy. James Mill had novel educational ideas, and his son John Stuart Mill was the perfect chance for him to put those into practice. He was going to train young John Stuart in a rigorous program of education, and Mill was to live to be the standard bearer for the next generation of utilitarians. And he had some success. Mill was a true child prodigy. He learned Greek at the age of 3, read 5 or 6 of the works of Plato by the time he was 8, started Latin at the time that he was 8. By the time he was 14, he was listening to lectures in natural science at university. He had mastered basic mathematics, science, astronomy. He actually wrote as an exercise, a continuation of the Iliad in Greek. So in those ways, he would seem to have been just the model student for this kind of rigorous education. It did backfire. At the age of 20, Mill suffered a nervous breakdown and contemplated suicide, as he tells us in his autobiography. He wondered whether the happiness that he hoped to bring to mankind was something that actually brought him any happiness. And he answered honestly, no, it's just all an academic matter to me. But he found some solace in the poetry of Wordsworth and came to the conviction that beauty can bring us joy and help us to have compassion for our fellow men. And that realization carried him forward for the rest of his life's work. He corresponded with Auguste Comte and became enamored of Comte's positive philosophy. He was also very interested in experiments in socialism, and his political and social views are fairly close to those of sort of mild English socialism, not the starker and more rabid kind of communism that we find in Marx and Engels. Mill notes in his autobiography that he was raised utterly without religious beliefs, and he remained an agnostic to the end of his days. In fact, one of the interesting things about reading Mill on the subjects of interest to us is that Mill seems not only never to have changed his beliefs on any of these points, but also never really to have engaged with the pre-existing literature in a deep way. He's familiar with some of the illustrations. He'll mention a name here or there, but there are many places where he seems to be reinventing the wheel and giving answers to standard Christian ideas, which answers had already been contested thoroughly in the Deist controversy, in the works of Butler and Paley, and he does not go back to any deep engagement with those works. That may be the reason that his remarks occasionally dropped on religion in general and on miracles and prophecy in particular never generated the kind of avalanche of response that Hume's essay of miracles generated. I think, in the main, people who read Mill and were familiar with that earlier literature said to themselves, this has all been addressed before, and rightly or wrongly, they felt those answers were sufficient, and therefore there's not a whole lot of reaction to Mill, at least not by comparison with the sort of reaction that other critics of Christianity received. There are four principal sources for Mill's views on religion. There is his System of Logic, and in Book 3, Chapter 25 of the System of Logic, there is a particular chapter on the grounds of disbelief in which he surveys the argument from miracles. His autobiography in 1873 gives us some interesting windows on his own views. Most specifically, his three essays on religion. That work, especially the third of the essays on theism, has some pretty extensive discussion of the attempt to ground belief in a deity on the reported miracles. We'll be following that chiefly as we move along. That's the main source that we want to look at. Also, in his correspondence, there are a few letters that shed some light on this. In particular, there's some correspondence from the spring of 1849 where he tries to explain what he meant by some phrases he used in his System of Logic. We'll come across those again in the three essays on religion, so I won't say any more about that. But if you're interested in looking into Mill on these matters, those are the sources that you will want to pull out. Mill's father had been raised in a rigid form of Calvinism and briefly considered studying for the ministry, but he abandoned Christianity in the face of the problem of evil, a problem which he felt was intractable given the idea of a God who had sovereign control over all future events. And Mill himself says in his autobiography that unlike many of his contemporaries, he did not lose his faith, but only because he had never had any faith to lose. When he comes in his three essays on religion to discuss the idea of the existence of God, he does so as a pure academic exercise. He's grave and measured in his tone. There is not any irreverence in his manner of writing. There's also no reverence. It's just an exercise for him. He espouses a strong agnosticism about any sort of theism. That is to say, he believes not only that he does not know whether there is some kind of deity, but that he cannot know, and neither can you. Such evidence as there is may enable us not unreasonably to hope that there is such a being, but that is the furthest we can go. And such a being would have to be a limited deity, like the demiurge in Plato's Timaeus, not capable of bringing about a universe free from pain and suffering, because otherwise, if he were good, he would have done so. So here's a quotation from the Three Essays on Religion, where he just brushes past that. What is morally objectionable in the Christian theory of the world is objectionable only when taken in conjunction with a doctrine of an omnipotent God. Because if there were an omnipotent God, then evil is his fault. So you can see a rather straightforward and not terribly sophisticated version of the problem of evil lying at the base of his entire approach to religion. We will come back to this because he brings back the problem of evil as he's discussing miracles in an interesting sort of way. Considered in the abstract, miracles are not logically impossible. We cannot rule out the possibility of these kinds of contingent events happening, because we cannot rule out the possibility of there being some sort of supernatural being capable of and desirous of bringing them about. That's pretty weak, though, as a ground for belief. The mere fact that we cannot rule it out does not mean that it's well evidenced. Also, there's a layer between us and the best sort of evidence we could wish for, at least for Protestants who don't believe that there are miracles happening in their own time. The evidence to them is not the evidence of their senses, but rather the evidence of testimony. Now, Hume's given an argument against belief in miracles that are relayed to you by testimony, but his argument has, Mill says, two weaknesses. First of all, it appeals only to negative evidence. I haven't seen a miracle, you haven't seen a miracle, which is not as strong as positive evidence. This is a point that is of interest to Mill because of his familiarity with the canons of Anglo-American law. In the English tradition, and Bentham had written a multi-volume work on evidence in law, and Mill had edited that work and written his own notes to it. Positive testimony, say that someone said something or that someone was at a certain place at a certain time, is considered to have greater weight than negative testimony that the person was not at that place at that time or that the person did not say those words. And the reason is fairly straightforward. There are some ordinary sources of human failure to notice things. There's just sheer inattention, distraction, want of memory, and equally honest witnesses, one testifying that a certain person was at a certain place and another testifying that he was not, are not on an equal footing. There are many natural ways, without impugning someone's honesty, to account for the fact that he didn't notice something. There are fewer ways to account for someone's positive testimony without attributing dishonesty to him. So, in canons of English law, positive testimony outweighs negative, but Hume's argument seems to rely upon the negative. So there's a worry that Mill is going to have to try to patch up. The second is that the testimony against miracles is not so uniform as Hume suggests. Hume's argument moves forward along the premise that there is universal testimony against a miracle. That's almost part of what is required for it to count as a miracle at all. And yet, Hume himself says that the accounts of all sorts of nations are brimful of miracles. So how is it possible that there can be uniform testimony against miracles if also the accounts of antiquity are full of them? Well, of course, what Hume wants to say is, but you don't believe those, do you? Mill, however, is considering the matter purely as an abstract problem and notes that Hume can't have it both ways. Either the accounts of the histories of ancient people do report miracles straightforwardly, as if they had happened, or they don't. And in fact, they do. So Hume has overstated his case. That does not mean that Mill is unsympathetic to Hume. He says that the rational presumption against a miracle is much stronger than it is against a merely new and surprising fact. Now, this is a place where, in the system of logic, he just barely touches Campbell's dissertation on miracles, and he accuses Campbell of a fallacy in reasoning, whether rightly or wrongly. It's not of terrible importance here, but just in passing, he wants to say that the presumption against a miracle is stronger than it is against a surprising fact. And here's why. New facts can be brought under laws. They are reproducible phenomena. If we set up the conditions again, we have the same effects again. Whereas a miracle is precisely not a reproducible phenomenon. And he has some disparaging remarks about the miracles of the New Testament not being the sorts of things, in fact, there being no record of someone who raises people from the dead on a regular basis. Some Christian theologians would, of course, immediately retort that if you read the Gospels, you see repeatedly the same kind of things. This is why crowds of people who were sick came to Jesus, because he was reported to have been able to heal many, many people. In some of the Gospel accounts, it says, and he healed them all. So Hume may be shading the facts a little bit there in favor of his own view of how things went down. But he does admit that this kind of an argument against belief in a miracle has little to rest upon until we get to a comparatively recent stage in the progress of science, where the universal dependence of physical phenomena on invariable laws can be taken as a scientifically established truth. Although Hume does not openly discuss D'Holbach's system of nature, there is here a point of contact in his view of nature as this mechanical apparatus grinding along with everything that happens being the inevitable result of prior physical causes, and Hume's own view of human freedom, which is a compatibilist view of human freedom, according to which freedom consists simply in the ability to do that which you desire to do, leaving out of account the question of whether you have any control over your desires or any control over the gratification of those desires. So Hume is an anti-libertarian when it comes to the question of free will. That will come up again in a moment as we continue to look at what he has to say in his three essays on religion. He raises the following objection for his own point of view. Miracles are violations of natural laws just as much or as little as the voluntary acts of human beings. After all, when you put a circus performer into a cannon and shoot him hundreds of yards through the air, his trajectory through the air is defined very nicely by some natural laws that we can lay down, and so we can tell you pretty much exactly where he will land. What we can't tell you is what he'll do after he gets up after landing. His actions at that point cease to be the kinds of things that are even roughly predictable by the laws of physics. So it seems like the behavior of free beings, their decisions, deliberations, choices, fall outside the scope of the reproducible phenomena to which Hume wants to Mill wants to reduce everything. And he admits that that's a fair response, but then he says that's only going to work if we have the same kind of evidence for the existence of divine interference that we have for human interference. Here, in a rather touchingly naive display of his empiricist epistemology, he just says, but you can see that the human actions are produced by secondary means. They're produced by moving objects. I draw back the elastic on my slingshot and then I let fly. So you can see that I'm making use of things which can be described in physical terms, the properties and behavior of which can be subsumed under physical laws. But you can't see that with God. God is operating, if at all, only directly. Now, he does make an exception, and this is kind of curious. Mill says, in the case of human actions, except for actions of the human body, because there we don't have a window onto the secondary causes. At some point, it would seem, our wills simply make our bodies move. Now, Mill himself, not being enamored of libertarian freedom, would probably have gone in for a more melancholy kind of determinism with respect to human actions. And that may have played some role in his depression that he mentions when he was 20 years old. But he doesn't come back to it. He doesn't touch on that again in the three essays on religion. So he's raised a possible place there where there's actually a very good parallel. He hasn't really done a lot to dispel it. But he says, when you look at an alleged miracle, there's always a better explanation than the supernatural explanation. Here's how he puts it. In this merely speculative explanation, there is always another hypothesis possible, viz., that the event may have been produced by physical causes in a manner not apparent. So long, therefore, as the miraculous character of the event is but an inference from the supposed inadequacy of the laws of physical nature to account for it, so long will the hypothesis of a natural origin for the phenomenon be entitled to preference over that of a supernatural one. That's a rather striking passage, because what he is saying is an extraordinarily strong claim. As long as your inference is less than conclusive, whatever for Mill conclusive is supposed to mean, he has some rather odd views on conclusive inductions, but so long as it's inconclusive, there will be a possibility, and that possibility always deserves preference. So here is a classic statement of the superiority of any naturalistic explanation, no matter how contrived, no matter how far-fetched, over any supernatural explanation, unless you've caught direct sight of God on your radar. The commonest principles of sound judgment, he goes on to say, forbid us to suppose for any effect a cause of which we have absolutely no experience, unless all those of which we have experience are ascertained to be absent. Those of you who have studied the history of science may recognize here two things. First of all, there's the old induction by elimination argument of Bacon that says to find the true cause of something, we list all of the possible causes, and then we eliminate all of the other causes except for that one, then we know that we have the right one. The other is the kind of caution in making hypotheses that Isaac Newton expresses both in some correspondence that he wrote and in his Principia Mathematica at the beginning of Book 3 on the System of Nature. Newton says that there are rules of reasoning in natural philosophy, and among those rules of reasoning is the rule that we must not argue by hypotheses, but must rather rigorously induce what hypotheses we have from the data by the smallest possible steps away from the data. So here Mill is being a good Baconian, perhaps also a good Newtonian. Now, it's remarkable that there was a debate going on in the philosophy of science at this very time, and Mill got himself involved in it in his examination of Sir William Hamilton's philosophy, and that dispute has consequences for some of his remarks about hypotheses as explanations. So there's another possible place for some of you who are interested in this material to do a little investigation, and if you're going to do that, there's a book that we will incorporate into the database on the Battle of the Philosophies, published anonymously. It's a survey of the debate between Mill and Hamilton, and it was written by Lucy March Phillips, one of the few women to have made significant contributions to this debate in the 19th century. So if that issue is of interest to you, we'll put up Lucy March Phillips' book, at least in a link. It doesn't deal directly with miracles, but because the controversy at this point has spilled over into the philosophy of science, it is a relevant source. Now, Mill goes on, there are few things of which we have more frequent experience than of physical facts, which our knowledge does not enable us to account for because they depend either on laws, which observation aided by science has not yet brought to light, or on facts, the presence of which, in the particular case, is unsuspected by us. In other words, our ignorance of the natural causes of things places us in a position where we ought to suspend any interpretation that involves the supernatural and wait for the progress of natural science to fill in the gaps in our knowledge, a kind of science of the gaps, if you will. It might be useful to compare what Mill is saying here, and I've given you the direct quotation so that I can't subject you to the worry that maybe I've misrepresented him. Compare this with what Robert Boyle says in the late 17th century in works like The Christian Virtuoso, where he says if you want to know whether something is a miracle, your best move is to study natural science, because the student of nature will know both the scope and the limits of natural causes and will therefore be both the least likely to be imposed upon by fraud and the least likely to put aside a priori things that might actually be divine interventions. So at this point, Mill does not engage with Boyle, but Boyle has anticipated the kind of move that Mill is making. So you might want to look for Robert Boyle's work in connection with that. Going on with Mill, it is always possible that there may be at work some undetected law of nature, which the wonder worker may have acquired consciously or unconsciously the power of calling into action, or that the wonder may have been wrought, as in the truly extraordinary feats of jugglers, by the employment, unperceived by us, of ordinary laws, which also need not be a case of voluntary deception. Maybe they think they're working miracles, but they're not. Or, lastly, the event may have had no connection with the volition at all, but the coincidence between them may be the effect of craft or accident, as if one were to command an eclipse of the sun at the moment when one knew by astronomy that an eclipse was on the point of taking place. Cue some of your Star Wars memories here, or references to some of the novels of Rider Haggard, in both of which the quote-unquote prediction of an eclipse figures as a plot device. There is, in short, nothing to exclude, notice the strong word exclude, nothing to exclude the supposition that every alleged miracle was due to natural causes. And as long as that supposition remains possible, barely possible, no scientific observer and no man of ordinary practical judgment would assume by conjecture a cause which no reason existed for supposing to be real, save the necessity of accounting for something which is sufficiently accounted for without it. Again, the question, what do you mean sufficiently accounted for without it? Because he seems to be saying that the bare fact that, totally unbeknownst to us, there might be some physical cause does the work here. Whether the bare existence of such a thing counts as a sufficient account is a question that deserves some examination. Wrapping up, the existence of God cannot possibly be proved by miracles, for unless a God is already recognized, the apparent miracle can always be accounted for, there's that phrase again, accounted for, on a more probable hypothesis than that of the interference of a being whose very existence is supposed to be the sole, of whose very existence it is supposed to be the sole evidence. Thus far, Hume's argument is conclusive. Now, it's a really interesting fact that as you get into the bowels of Mill's argument, he brings back the problem of evil, the problem that lay at the heart of his own rejection of Christian theism. Here's how he puts it. Again, a direct quotation from the Three Essays on Religion. If we reason directly from God's goodness to positive facts, no misery, nor vice, nor crime ought to exist in the world. We can see no reason in God's goodness why, if he deviated once from the ordinary system of his government, if he once performed a miracle, in order to do good to man, he should not have done so on 100 other occasions. It may draw to your recollection a remark of Jesus in the Gospels, asking his disciples whether there were no other widows in the Old Testament besides the one to whom the prophet was sent. Of course there were. So why didn't God send a prophet to every one of them? This is not exactly an unanticipated line of objection. Back to Mill. Nor why, if the benefit aimed at by some given deviation, such as the revelation of Christianity, was transcendent and unique, that precious gift should only have been vouchsafed after the lapse of many ages. Or why, when it was at last given, the evidence of it should have been left open to so much doubt and difficulty. These are, of course, objections that one needs to deal with. what's remarkable about Mill's treatment is that even though he will refer now and again to Butler's analogy of religion, he shows no awareness that these things have all been covered in part two, chapter six of the analogy in great detail. In fact, the analogy of religion, part two, chapter six, is probably the best starting place for anyone who wants to engage with a contemporary literature on divine hiddenness. So here again, just notice the way that Mill puts this. I'm just continuing the quotation from the previous slide. If God intended that mankind should receive Christianity or any other gift, it would have agreed better with all that we know of his government to have made provision in the scheme of creation for its arising at the appointed time by natural development, which, let it be added, all the knowledge we now possess concerning the history of the human mind tends to the conclusion that it actually did, a rare moment when Mill allows a little sarcasm to break in. Now, that's substantially the objection of Voltaire, the objection of Peter Annett, and the objection, in fact, of Spinoza, that it would be beneath the dignity of God to have to come muddling along and interfering in human affairs. If he wanted to get this job done right, he should have done it at the beginning, and if he was omnipotent, he could have. That is, again, one of the reasons why Mill thinks that the traditional view of an omnipotent as well as benevolent God is a non-starter. I'll just remark that although Paley's Evidences of Christianity was written before Mill was born, in the preparatory considerations, he considers and engages with this kind of objection and offers an answer to it. So those of you who are interested in that may find that you need to go backwards as well as forwards. So now I'm pointing you to Paley as well as to Butler for some engagement with the kind of argument that Mill is bringing up. And again, this is the reason I think that there wasn't much of a reaction to Mill's remarks, because people who knew the literature said quite reasonably, hey, these issues have already been dealt with. Again, Mill, on the weakness of the evidence for the Christian miracles, think here of Hume, and then compare this with what we have in primary source evidence. Again, not miraculous accounts, but simply accounts of people's reactions to reported miracles. Taken at the best, it, the evidence for the Christian miracles, is the uncross-examined testimony of extremely ignorant people, credulous as such usually are, unaccustomed to draw the line between the perceptions of sense and what is superinduced upon them by the suggestions of a lively imagination, unversed in the difficult art of deciding between appearance and reality and between the natural and the supernatural. In times, moreover, when no one thought it worthwhile to contradict any alleged miracle. These are very strong statements. He would have a hard time, I think, substantiating them if someone were to bring him down to a close examination of the text of the Gospels, but he's not interested in that kind of examination. He's taking a view from a height, rather like Hume. Such were the witnesses, and even of them, we do not possess the direct testimony. The documents of late date long subsequent, even on the Orthodox theory, which contain the only history of those events, very often do not even name the supposed eyewitnesses. This might be a point for cross-checking what he has to say with some of the most recent work on the subject. I'm thinking now of Richard Baucom's book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, which contains a sustained argument that not only do the Gospels contain eyewitness testimony, but also the authors of those Gospels frequently identify those eyewitnesses by the literary device of inclusio, in which they name the witnesses from whom the testimony is taken at the beginning and at the ending of sections in which they're making use of that testimony. So Baucom's work would be a relevant modern point of contact if you're interested in engaging with what Mill says here. Also, look at various passages in the Gospels. You can see those on the slide. And the description of the Sadducees, both in the Book of Acts and in the Antiquities of the Jews by Josephus. The Sadducees, of course, were the dominant religious sect in Jerusalem, having the closest connection with Herod, having the control of the temple, and utterly disbelieving in the resurrection of the dead, that being one of the central tenets on which they disagreed with the Pharisees. Like Hume, And like others before Hume, Mill is very taken by the idea of giving an account of the natural order, origin of miracle stories. It is also noticeable, and is a very important consideration, he says, that stories of miracles only grow up among the ignorant, and are adopted, if ever, by the educated when they have already become the belief of multitudes. A modern point of reference here would be the data collected in Craig Keener's two-volume work on miracles, much of which has to do with reports of miracles in the developed world, modern miracles from hospitals in Florida and other places not long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away. C.S. Lewis's friend Austin Farrer is also said to have included the following question on Oxford exams, probably driven to it by the kind of chronological snobbery that Mill seems to be engaging in here. Just how ignorant was a first century Jew? Didn't know where babies come from? Didn't realize that dead men stay dead? What exactly is it that is supposed to be the best difficult art of separating appearance from reality? Are we really trying to say that in the first century you couldn't tell the difference between your close friend sitting with you, conversing with you, and a corpse? Is that really the claim? The conclusion I draw, says Mill, is that miracles have no claim whatever to the character of historical facts and are wholly invalid as evidences of any revelation. So that's his summing up of his position. Matthew Arnold is another example of an urbane skeptic, but his whole habit of mind is very different. He was an English poet, a man of letters. He made his living as an inspector of schools, and in that role, he traveled by rail, which was, of course, recently introduced in England, across the length and breadth of the land. It was a job that he hated, but it probably gave him closer connection with the views of the working public than just about any other man in England at his time. Arnold was the son of the eminent English historian Thomas Arnold, who was the master of Rugby. Thomas Arnold, his father, had been a close friend of Richard Whateley. We'll see more about Whateley as we move on in the course. He was also the uncle of Mary Augusta Ward. She was the daughter of his brother Tom Arnold, also a figure in English literary circles. Matthew Arnold's best known for his poetry, especially Dover Beach. In fact, he has some claim to be one of the great 19th century poets, comparable in stature perhaps to Alfred Lord Tennyson, the poet laureate at the time. But his work that we are most concerned with is found primarily in two books, Literature and Dogma, and then God and the Bible, which was a book he put out 10 years later defending Literature and Dogma against some of the assaults that had been made on it. The latter two works did to some extent scandalize the British public because Arnold just said forthrightly, the existing forms of Christianity have to go. He did not see this as a cause for celebration. Here's a line from one of his poems, stanzas from the Grand Chartreuse, a monastery in France. Wandering between two worlds, one dead, the other powerless to be born, with nowhere yet to rest my head like these, on earth I wait forlorn. What are the two worlds? Well, there's the world that was, the world in which an intelligent and well-informed man could believe wholeheartedly in Christianity as a miraculous revelation supported by miracles and prophecy, take the story of salvation as it came, and the world in which the progress of man and science, not just scientific progress, but moral progress, would lead us on. The perfectibility of man, an ideal and yet so far away, a world that Tennyson describes in his poem In Memoriam, of those that eye to eye shall look on knowledge, under whose command is earth and earths, and in whose hand is nature, like an open book. Science is on the move, but human misery still abounds. We haven't reached the stage that we ought to be able to reach, that he would like us to reach, and we need the help of something that Christianity has preserved to do that. Christianity, then, for Arnold, is a husk of doctrines around a kernel of vital truth. And it's a vital truth that he expresses in almost pantheistic language, redolent of Spinoza, though he rarely mentions Spinoza outright. There is something eternal, not ourselves, that makes for righteousness. That phrase, which I think he is picking up from Reville, a French liberal theologian, is a phrase that he repeats, especially in God and the Bible. He just beats it like a drum. For him, this phrase encapsulates exactly what he is trying to say. There is something that's not ourselves. We can dress it in the garb of a personal being. We can record its utterances as if they were utterances to us and for us. But in fact, that's poetry. That's literature. We have to give up the appeal to miracles and prophecy as evidences for revelation. Because as long as they're considered to be integral parts of the Christian religion, working people, and remember, he traveled back and forth across England, looking into schools, listening not only to the complaints of students, but probably to the complaints of their parents. Working people will abandon traditional Christianity. And in doing it, they will lose something inexpressibly valuable. They are not going to abandon it for more refined religious views. They are going to abandon it for the blank secularism of a W.K. Clifford or a Charles Bradlaugh. And that is going to leave them miserable and impoverished. Not physically impoverished, though perhaps that too, but spiritually impoverished. And Arnold sincerely cares about this. Christianity, he says, is immortal. It has eternal truth, inexhaustible virtue, a boundless future. But our popular religion at present conceives the birth, ministry, and death of Christ as altogether steeped in prodigy, brimful of miracle. And miracles do not happen. That line, which occurs only in the preface to the popular edition of Literature and Dogma, the 1883 edition of a work originally published in 1873, is a line that resonated with many of Arnold's contemporaries. We'll see it coming up again in just a moment. The Bible, he says, describes the eternal, his capitalization, in the language of poetry and emotion. We must read it as literature, therefore. Read it as poetry. Read it as an emotional expression, not as a record of historical fact. But we don't. We read it as a record of physical miracle. And why? Well, because for a while, and for the unsophisticated intellect, miracle has a strong psychological hold on our imaginations. Suppose, he writes, a very famous passage of Literature and Dogma, I could change the pen with which I write this into a pen wiper. I could turn the pen into a little object made of cloth on which I wipe my nib in order to make my writing more clean. I should not thus make what I write any the truer or more convincing. That may be so in reality, but the mass of mankind feel differently. In the judgment of the mass of mankind, could I visibly and undeniably change the pen with which I write this into a pen wiper, not only would this which I write acquire a claim to be held perfectly true and convincing, but I should even be entitled to affirm and to be believed in affirming propositions the most palpably at war with common fact and experience. Miracle claims, in other words. Now, whether miracle claims are at war with fact and experience was precisely one of the points on which the deists engaged their orthodox opponents, and the orthodox opponents would have disagreed quite violently with this description. All you need to do is go back and read William Adams's essay in answer to Mr. Hume's essay on miracles to see that Adams insists that there be a common flow of experience, not miraculous. It's only against such a backdrop that we can see a miracle for what it is, a work that announces God's presence by doing what only God can do, by the act of sovereignty. One of two things must be made out in order to place either the Bible miracles alone or the Bible miracles and the miracles of the Catholic Church with them in a class by themselves. Either they must be shown to have arisen in a time eminently unfavorable to amplification and the production of legend, or they must be shown to be recorded in documents of an eminently historical mode of birth and publication. But surely it is manifest that the Bible miracles fulfill neither of these conditions. Now, whether those are the right conditions, and whether either or both of the miracles of those two classes fulfill those conditions, was a subject much discussed. So to take just three examples, Leslie's short and easy method with the deists from the very late 17th century, Douglas's criterion, an answer to Hume in the late 18th century, and Warfield's counterfeit miracles, all of these are works that have engaged with that question. The first two lay within the history to which Arnold might have appealed, but he does not engage with them, or at least doesn't show any evidence of having engaged with them in any detail. We'll come back to a comment about Leslie there in a moment. How about prophecy? Well, if there were a prophecy really delivered beforehand, beyond the reach of human sagacity or plausible guesswork, genuinely fulfilled, then that does seem to be evidence, perhaps even evidence for theological doctrines. But, he says, many apparently fulfilled prophecies arise from misreading or mistranslation. For misreading, he cites examples of several of the New Testament prophecies. Not a bone of his shall be broken. Well, if you go back in the Old Testament and read that, that's clearly to be taken as a sign of divine protection, whereas the fact that none of Jesus' bones were broken could hardly be said to have been a sign of divine protection. The man's just been killed by crucifixion. So that can't be the right reading of the Old Testament. So he accuses the earliest Christians of promoting a map of misreadings of the Old Testament. This also is a question that had been dealt with extensively, and we could have wished that he might at least have told us what he thinks of some of the work of Edward Chandler, the bishop who engaged with Woolston and Collins in the deist controversy on the subject of prophecy. But he does not. We're going to be disappointed that way. Mistranslation. He gives us several examples. Genesis 49:10 should be translated, so long as the people resort to Shiloh, so long as they go to Shiloh to worship, rather than until Shiloh come, as if it were a prediction of someone's coming who would bring peace. Jeremiah 23, we should translate this, the name whereby they shall call themselves, the Eternal, is our righteousness, rather than the accepted translation, he shall be called the Lord, our righteousness. These are just two of the examples that he offers, and his translations, it's interesting to note, have not been the choice of most modern translators, even those who have revised the Bible, the modern Net Bible. The translations with which he seems to get away from the idea of a prophetic element here are now pretty widely discarded. However, he thought that they were the best translations available at the time. Again, a literary man's mode of proceeding in the argument. He claims that Leslie's short and easy methods with the deists, he gets the title wrong as well, is aimed at Collins and others at that time. He gets the chronology reversed here. Leslie is writing about three decades before Collins is writing, so he's about a generation offset. It's little references like this that suggest to me that Arnold had not actually made any careful study of the earlier literature. He's counting on secondhand reports, memories of it. This is not something he has gone back to engage with himself, probably because he thought it would not have been worth his time. A couple of reactions to Arnold, and I'll close with this. Very interesting reaction, something that came out in the year of Arnold's death, was a novel by Mary Augusta Ward, or Mrs. Humphrey Ward, as the title page puts it. Robert Elsmere. This is a novel where the main character is a clergyman. He loses his faith in traditional Christianity, but he finds renewed purpose in a kind of social gospel. There's an impassioned speech at the end of the novel, and the climactic line of that speech is, "Miracles do not happen." I think it is not an accident that Ward was Matthew Arnold's niece and chose that line as the climactic line of the entire work. The novel was wildly popular. It sold crazy numbers on both sides of the Atlantic, and there's just a curious little literary incident. The copyright laws were not respected at all between England and America, so when something was published in England, that you very frequently had a knockoff copy published in America without any royalties being given to the original author. It's just a curious literary fact that one of the American publishers did so well selling copies of this novel that he sent Mrs. Ward a check for $500 and let it be known that if sales continued, he'd be sending her another check for $500, not because she had any copyright agreement with him. He was flagrantly violating copyright, but just as a sort of a gesture designed to obtain the goodwill of people who were maybe angry with him for having published without her permission. There's a book that is in the database that you will want to look at if you are interested in Matthew Arnold, and that's Alexander Balmain Bruce's book, The Chief End of Revelation. You can see by the date, 1881, that it came out 8 years after the publication of Literature and Dogma. There is also a subsequent edition of Bruce, and he may engage some with God in the Bible there. I haven't gone back to check that. But he does at multiple times engage with the lines of argument that Arnold has put forward. So he's very careful on this point to engage with someone who was one of the dominant literary figures of the day. So if you're looking for direct engagement with Arnold, at least, Bruce's book is an important place for you to go. That's it for today's lecture.